is painting a picture of abstract beauty and profound power across the water. I am drinking instant coffee that, paired with the taste of yesterday's sunblock on my lips, tastes like camping. Occasionally, a woodpecker hops by. At least I've identified the strange-looking bird as a woodpecker because of its remarkable similarity to Woody. All of this is true. It is obviously, almost obnoxiously, summer. Except my shoulders hurt wildly. Hurt in the way they do when I am stressed about school, which I am. This is because for the past 3 hours of sleep, the only 3 continuous hours granted me by my daughter, back from squirrels and currently holding my phone and dancing to LMFAO in the middle of the room, slightly diminishing the feeling of my perfect and still summer morning. I dreamt about day after day of school. I had meetings that were demeaning and passive-aggressive. You see, my school, award-winning and consistently gaining national and international attention, is run completely wrong. It's run so wrong that people are quitting, giving up mid-year. So wrong that last summer numerous people were hired for new jobs and quit before they started because they were scared off by the way we do things. So wrong that while the morning shifts from sunned to sunny, and my daughter is already wearing her swimsuit in anticipation of a water park we are going to in 4 hours, my shoulders hurt from a meeting in a dream, and nearly everyone I work with would understand why. One major problem in my school is that, fairly often, we are awful to each other. I'll get back to bosses, but before you deal with them, you need to deal with whoever works next door, and the neighbors in my neighborhood have been acting a damn fool. There's infighting, as there would be with any organization, but my God, I swear there's a vicious life-or-death flavor to it that is incredibly unnecessary. It's also super complicated, so bear with me here while I try to sketch it out. Teacher A is newer to the school, only in their 3rd year. Their arrival on the floor was heralded by admin at first, but they have now been branded a troublemaker by Teacher B, and likely by administrators A and B. Teacher A has an alliance with teachers C, D, and E that is friendly and involves lunches with laughing and knowledge of partners' names and careers. Teacher A has an alliance with teachers F and G that is tenuous at best and formed mainly around their mutual dislike of teachers H and I. Oh my God, Teacher I. Almost the whole floor can't even begin to stand Teacher I. Teachers F and G use words like hate toward Teacher I. They also use words like fascist and oppression to describe Teacher I and Teacher I's relationship with Administrator B. Teacher I lives on an island in a sea of teachers who will not talk to or recognize the existence of a real live person I. You could draw a map of all that, but that map would just say second floor, and we've got 3 more floors after that. Oh, but here's the thing. Teacher C doesn't actually like Teacher A, and spreads rumors about Teacher A sleeping with Education Assistant A and Arts Teacher A. Teacher B thinks everyone is sleeping with everyone, or trying to, and also thinks all other teachers are whiny jerks. This is just the beginning, really. It gets a whole lot seedier from there. People wish harm on each other, say, maybe they'll get hit by a car, when they walk down the street. In fact, I think I said that once. I know I said that once. I said that recently about Teacher S. You see, though I really have no emotional attachment to any of the teachers represented through the alphabet of teachers, I hate S, and that big shiny S stands for Superman. Superman is not, you will not be surprised, the person's name, nor is it a representation of that person's ability. Superman is Superman only in all the ways that Superman is the douchiest of all superheroes and probably a total bummer to hang out with. I hate Superman. And it's ridiculous that I do. Superman never did anything to me. He's met my wife, child, and dog, and did not punch any one of them in the face. He's never stolen from me, spit on me, or, to be honest, been anything other than mildly unpleasant to me. I just hate his stupid face and his stupid hair and his stupid way that he says stupid things. I'm wrong. Whenever you sound like a 5-year-old describing your relationship with another human being, you are wrong, and it's time for you to stop being wrong. One thing that Superman does wrong and something that contributes to my hatred of him, and one thing that the alliances and battles serve, is that he believes that anything we do at school can be done by ourselves, so he doesn't need anyone else. Wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Why? Because kids walk out of your room and into others. Because kids can feel dysfunction before they get off the bus in the morning. Because kids deserve the efforts of everyone working together instead of everyone working alone. Because kids deserve teachers who other teachers can question and critique and inform and support. Here's my hard-won bit of wisdom, developed after a few years of watching my talent as a lecturer and curriculum developer count for much less than I thought it would. If you're going to be good at this, you're not going to do it alone. So I get frustrated with Superman, carry that frustration around like a brick on a rope around my neck, hanging backwards. Then, every few months, I pull my head out of my ass and I walk up to him and say something well-rehearsed and insightful. Usually it's something like, "Hey!" Then he says, "Hey!" And then, whatever. We're fine for a while. We are two incredibly difficult white men with two incredibly huge white man egos. But both of us are able to recognize that this whole thing we're doing is more important than that. Work is too silly to get into fights about. Teaching is too important to let dumb things like someone's stupid spiky hair get in the way, especially someone who also cares deeply about kids and has neat thoughts and lots of energy to make things better. After lesson plans and grading and special ed meetings and pulling that kid aside at the end of the day who said that thing that you were pretty sure meant he wanted to do something impossible and illegal to half the women in the world, but whose slang, when translated, revealed something about how wet means cool and shoes meant shoes, and so actually he was just talking about going shopping. After all that, I have about 3.5 minutes to try to fix any problems in the school that are not things literally on fire. Smoldering will be ignored. That means a whole heck of a lot of leadership, and by leadership I mean rumors, happens outside of the school day. This is time I could be with my family, or not with my family, or whatever. So is it worth spending time during actual real person time trying to plot the destruction of Superman? No. Superman is a dweeb, but Lex Luthor is an asshole. It's all about priorities. In the time that we have, we can try to fix maybe the top 3 problems in the school building over the course of a year. If we can forget the smaller problems as often as possible, we have a better chance of fixing the big ones. Knowing so helps me listen to a lot of dumb shit from people I don't like because I know I don't have to fix whatever it is, not until we're about 80 problems down the line. Besides, the other great thing about focusing on big problems is that the big problems are often the ones everyone agrees on, even the dumb people I don't like. So sure, Superman, I don't think your work Facebook picture should be one of you with your shirt off. But let's sit and talk about increasing involvement in our arts opportunities. Let's make something happen. And again, I woke up this morning so stressed by work stuff that didn't even happen that I couldn't relax watching a river at nearly dawn. So, it's hard to pretend I'm a master of not letting stuff get to me, but here's the thing. The thing big enough it gets its own paragraph. It's work. It's just work. The worst thing anyone can do to you is fire you. That's it. If you start to hear people use words like oppression or compare your workplace to Soviet-era Russia with regards to email etiquette or bus duty, and especially if you hear all those things in the same 5 minutes of one union meeting, it's time to start remembering that somewhere, sometime soon, there will be actual kids counting on you to be grown-ups and give them tools for their real lives. Which isn't to say that it doesn't get bad, and it isn't to say that it doesn't get hard. It's just work, sure, but it's also your profession, and it's the place and the thing that you spend more time and energy on than all the other things in your life combined. So when you get yelled at or treated poorly, it stings. When I was a first-year teacher, there was a situation at another school in our district. A teacher, talking to his elementary class, answered a question honestly about who lived in his home. See, he was a man, and he lived with his partner, who was a man. And he didn't lie to his kids about this very human thing. He sent a letter home that day with the students letting their parents know that the conversation came up and that some kids may have questions. No biggie. Like, actually, not even a decade later, this is not even a thing anymore. During that year, though, just a few days later, there were protesters outside the building and news articles and a pile and a half of ridiculous. The district stood behind the teacher, and I wanted to as well. I talked to my students about it, and 2 students wrote a letter to the editor of the paper. That letter got sent from my work email, and suddenly I was being called to the office. In my school, there were 2 ways to be called to the office. There was the call asking when you had a moment, "Could you please come up?" And then there was Kathy. Kathy was a licensed teacher who ran our after-school program but was free from school duties during large parts of the day. Sometimes they just sent Kathy to watch your class with a message that you were wanted upstairs right now. This was never, ever a good thing. So it was a Kathy day. My assistant principal yelled at me for a while. Yelled. Out loud. Adult to adults, presumably, and professional to professional, I suppose. I was called to the principal's office and yelled at. When she was done, she got the principal on the phone. He was at the hospital, as his first child had been born the day before. He, from the hallway outside of the room of his day-old offspring, yelled at me some more. I shouldn't have sent anything from school email. Check. I know I'm not a reliable source here, but I promise you, it wasn't that big of a deal. I was sent back to my room. I was told the superintendent would be notified, and that the superintendent would likely be talking to me soon. So it was a crying day. That was a day of stomach removal badness. At a certain point, I was sitting in my room, staring at a wall, wondering if I should wait to get fired or go upstairs and quit. The assistant principal, AP, walked into my room looking rather somber. I talked to the superintendent. I wasn't in the mood to talk anymore, and when I get really angry, I get silent. He said that I should come down and apologize. Record scratch sound. He said I should tell you that your job is safe. Your intentions should be applauded, and that I should come down and tell you that, because you were probably feeling like you just got your butt kicked. Record exploding into a billion pieces sound. I was. This, administrator friends, if I had any, is how you get loyal-ass employees. There were many situations over the following 6 years that it would have been beneficial to me, or at least far easier for me, to jump on the pile of people saying bad things about the superintendent when some of his shit hit the fan. But nope. I had his back. I had his back. And just happened in those 6 years to find myself in a leadership position where my having his back meant something. Not just because he helped me out. Not just because he didn't yell at me. But because he treated me like a real live person on a day that no one else did. Hey, be a person who does that. When I was a 50-year teacher, I was a man of big ideas and boundless energy. I was having a masterpiece year. I was having my Black Album year. I won some awards. I had multiple programs I was working on included in building tours. I had an AP who would come to me to ask for approval for things happening in the building, and a supportive principal who would sign off on most any idea I sent his way. Above all that, I worked with a team of teachers that, given 3 years, $5,000, and a whiteboard, could have fixed all of education everywhere. Things were so very good. We called ourselves the family, because we saw each other way more than we saw our actual families, and we were all entirely different from one another. In fact, we worked because we were all entirely different from one another. Our math teacher, Kristen, was organized, well-researched, and pulled every stupid conversation we tried to have back to what was best right now for the kids in our room. She kept us grounded and focused on our work as an expression of care. She taught math with a patience, talent, and calm that was staggering. She was the caring mom for every kid who needed one, the mean mom for whenever someone's crazy needed to get shut down. I worked with her for 6 straight years and saw her get truly mad once. I've said so elsewhere and will say so again. She's the best teacher I've ever worked with. Our social studies teacher, Peter, was a man of big ideas and no patience for adult bullshit. He saw our school and our classes in terms of their potential to be something better, and worked constantly, when there wasn't a basketball game on, to shed all the stuff that didn't really matter. He was the first teacher I saw who centered social justice in his classroom in a way that promoted student voices above his own. He was nearly new when he started, and I almost instantly saw him as a mentor and leader. Still do. Always will. Our science teacher? Good Lord. Ruth. I don't know why, but just about every one of the craziest people I know is a middle school science teacher, and Ruth is their queen. Students made dictionaries just to try to understand her. She was loud and ridiculous. Her brain is apparently 3 overcaffeinated squirrels with their tails tied together. Also, she refused to let students do anything other than be amazing in her room. She taught science as an art, as a process, something you did, not just something you learned about. Ruth scared the shit out of me, Still does. But also, she's probably the best, worst person I know. Our English teacher was me. In the classroom, I am some sort of cross between Fozzie Bear and that dude from the movie Pi. Yes, the one who eventually gives himself a power drill lobotomy just to calm his brain down. Things were so very good because there is no right way to be a teacher except authentic. Wait, for real. There is no right way to teach. And we proved it every day by teaching four very different ways. There's no way for you to do it right except the way you do it. Things were so very good because we could push each other and hold each other up, and because we had this beautiful thing where we laughed and worried and worked together. Things were good because we built strength upon strength upon strength, and the students who didn't like my sarcasm could get actual human care in math, or a science teacher who would walk them around arm in arm if they were late too many times, or a social studies teacher who welcomed openly every little bit of whoever they were. I wasn't having a good year with a great team. I was having a great year because of them. Except, of course, then some stuff. Then there was this other teacher I was close friends with who I stopped being close friends with. She legitimately was a jerk to me, but I did my best to keep it all quiet and not tell people about it, except the people I told about it. But people notice and people talk because people are people and people are children. Problem was, one of the people talking was talking a lot. This one teacher went all over the damn school to discuss his theories of all the awful things I had done or tried to do that had led to me and friend teacher being me and former friend teacher. They weren't true, and I have no idea where he came up with them, but, you know, rumors are better than facts, and my name was suddenly in all sorts of people's mouths. Still, the problem was less what happened and more how I handled it. It bugged the shit out of me. Really, I was pissed for like a month straight while I focused on how wronged I felt, and imagining that everyone was as obsessed with me as I am. My work suffered. My team kept me afloat. But it wasn't exactly a magically happy time to work with me. Within a week of these conversations happening, my three major projects of the year were dismantled, two physically taken apart and put in closets. Later, I was offered an opportunity to transfer to another school, away from my team, and took it to transfer away from former friend teacher. Then, as happens, she got transferred to the same damn place, and I was without the family, and things were suddenly much less good. So, you know, it was less than great, and I handled it less than perfectly, and it still stings when I think about it. Plus, also, that same story told from the point of view of the no longer a friend would likely sound completely different, and I'd be the asshole. But whatever, I wasn't. Work sucks sometimes. There's no fix to make it all better except reminding myself it's just work. Some days I'm a better person, and I do things to support former friend and still boss because it's what's best for the school and what's best for the kids in the school. Some days I'm not a better person, and I want to do petty things just to watch people fail. And on those days, I at least find the energy to stay very quiet and walk away. Sometimes, surrounded by hundreds of students whose lives depend on you coming with your A-game every damn day, you are tempted again and again to worry about the drama of the adults around you. Lately, I've just been reminding myself that I'd rather spend my time and energy on things that are constructive and creative, rather than destructive. No one is implicitly evil. There are not right and wrong groups of people, and you know what? We know that. We really know that, and we hardly ever act like it. I let the drama derail me from the best teaching team I can imagine, from three of the only grown-ups in the world I can stand. And I did it because I was acting like a baby. It would have been cool if I could have just been a grown-up about all of it. It would be cool if we just all acted like actual grown-up professionals at work. Instead, we make caricatures of the people around us. People are easier to understand when we reduce and exaggerate what we see of them. In my building, for many years, there was tension between older and younger teachers. To the younger teachers, brimming with energy, ideas, and overconfidence, the older teachers were often standing in the way of progress. There was some truth here. When new ideas were brought forward in staff meetings, that new idea was often picked apart. We're already doing too many things. We shouldn't do it if we can't do it perfectly. Interesting, but in the past, what we've done is... Our oldest and loudest and almost exclusively male voices argued toward the status quo, and doing nothing new was often the only decision that made its way through the...
So we'll think about that for a while. Next year, maybe, if we start earlier. When things are taken off our plate first, then we can talk about...
So, to many newer teachers, the older teachers were cast as the cranky group. Their ideas and arguments, often born out of real, actual wisdom, were dismissed as avoidance of ideas that were not their own. Of course, what younger teachers were missing was that many of the things that made the school successful, many of the best parts of our day or year, started as ideas from these older, cranky teachers. Their arguments to do nothing were often arguments attempting to protect the programs they thought made our school special, ideas that only a few years ago were the new fancy ideas. To the older teachers, the younger teachers were blinded by what they saw as an abundance of support, especially for them. There was some truth in this. With a change in leadership in the school, the people being given the most input into building and district decisions were increasingly younger and younger, and almost exclusively female. Our building leadership team was mostly teachers with less than 5 years of experience, which, you can imagine, went over great with the veterans who literally built the place. Those younger teachers were often given the funding and support necessary to launch their new programs. The older teachers, feeling suddenly ignored and diminished, dismissed newer staff as the young, pretty things. There was some truth to this. There were some very attractive young teachers, but what the older group was missing about the younger group was that a large number of their ideas were very good. They were missing that a great idea 10 or 2 years ago may not be the best idea today. What most of us were missing was the fact that no one really belongs to a group wholly. What most of us were missing was the fact that no one enters education to do poorly, and no one goes to work just to ruin someone's day. So here's what we did to make work less awful. A group of us spread across both groups, but capable of non-jackassery, made enchiladas, and invited over a bunch of other people. We had a frank conversation about our school while drinking 200% more bottles of wine than was professional. We met each other around the table as people and not adversaries. It worked for a time. We created a new leadership group, an official one, with representation from all over the building. We went to each other as needed over the next few years to smooth disagreements and come to understandings. We promoted good ideas, and we worked to make them happen. People enter education because they want to do amazing things for kids, but they never, or very hardly ever, do them all alone. Crappy job, great career. Last year was a weird year among the staff of our high school. Our leaders, and leaders here meaning all four of us who had been teaching for longer than 3 years, were mired in a year of personal tragedy, financial crisis, and in my case, acute self-involvement in the form of writing about all of my feelings all the time. This left a lot of younger teachers on their own to figure out how they felt about things. Many found inspiration in their work and each other, supported one another through stressful days, and pushed each other to be better. A few went another route and found all the different happy hour deals within a 3-mile radius. This group had a mantra, spoken all too often. It's just a job. No wonder they were so salty all the time. I suppose teaching can be both a job and a career. I suppose during bus duty or supervising a dance or sitting through a meeting about setting up a meeting to discuss something sometime, I say to myself, fuck this job. But if the whole thing is a job, if the whole thing is just a job, you're doing it wrong. Teaching is a shitty job, but a great career. It's easy, so easy to complain. I am in the years now, and this was supposed to get easier. Just last week, I almost cried twice. Nothing bad had even happened. I almost cried, but didn't because I was just too tired. But it's worth it, ultimately, and actually way more than worth it. There are the obvious reasons why. I get paid to have summer vacation. I'm sure different districts do things differently, but my paychecks are the same in July when I'm pleasantly burning at a beach at noon on a Tuesday as they are in February when I fight through the snow for an hour for the chance to fight through an hour with my kids who fought through the snow to be there. All bullshittery aside, I get paid pretty well. I don't lift heavy things all day or paint houses or worry about how many widgets were made or sold or whatever. My job, the thing I'm paid to do, is to try to make kids better at things. There are people whose job it is to help me do that thing, and people whose job it is to make sure I'm doing my best to do that thing. But mainly, for the most part, I sit around and think of new creative ways for kids to think in new creative ways. I've painted houses before. It is better than painting houses. People are good to teachers. There are discounts and appreciation days and all sorts of things like that. People give you a look when you say, "I'm a teacher," that they give nurses and cops, which is good company to be in. Also, both those other jobs are way harder, I bet. I may be insanely naive or lucky or sheltered or something, but the only time I hear about how bad teachers are is when teachers talk about how everyone talks bad about them. I don't see it. Then again, I'm a white man, and there's a different dynamic with the way people talk about and perceive women and people of color who are in the classroom. Want a better reason to teach? A best one? Go ask 3 people who their favorite teacher in school was. Watch their eyes and listen to the way they talk about that teacher. You get to be that. Not for everyone, or even most kids, sure, but how many people do you need to touch in that way for it to be worth it? I have my number, and it is low. People come up to me sometimes, and they have run into a former student or the parent of a former student, and I am brought up. And I am told wonderful things those students say about me, about my teaching, about what those students are doing now because of, in part, things they heard or did in my classroom. I've never once driven past the house I painted 10 years ago just to see how it's doing. Once I had a mom tell me that her daughter was alive at the end of a year because of me. A week later, and unknowing of the previous conversation, the girl said the same thing. My being around at just the right time and not being an ass meant she was still alive. Just a job? In fact, let's talk about her, because she saved me too. I wasn't going to die or anything, but I was getting pretty damn close for the 10th time in my career to finding something else to do. I was in my first year in high school after 50,000 years teaching middle school with the 3 best teachers I've ever met. I remember looking around staff meetings at the new school and thinking, yeah, I don't like any of these fuckers. They were good teachers, mind you, but I didn't like them because I didn't like much of anything. Of course, those were adults, and I didn't get into teaching because I love sitting around in rooms of adults talking about teaching. There's always the kids, right? In the 2nd week of school, someone went into my desk and stole my phone. I gave an ill-planned, overly emotional speech to the class about the bond of trust we would need to form in order to blah, blah, blah. I was mocked. I was not a little mocked. I was severely, loudly mocked. I didn't get my phone back, but I did receive the delightful explanation that no one cares about your shit. Indeed. So it was that I was in my most defeated, my crankiest, my most fuck-this-jobbiest when a student came to me and said, "Do you have a minute?" It should be noted that being all those things probably also meant enough of my own walls were down that I didn't look like the strutting blowhard I can often come across as. So I had a minute. I have to let you know, though. I'd seen the look in her face before, and this was not going to be a conversation about easy things. I have a degree in English Lit, and a degree in English Education. So? So I'm just saying, I know a decent amount about books and writing and stuff, but I have no idea about how to talk to people about anything other than books and stuff. Yeah, I have a therapist for that. Great. Then I won't be your therapist. I'll be your English teacher. Fine. Do you want a granola bar? In addition to knowing a little bit about books and stuff, I also have granola bars. That's how it started. She sat and talked to me for about 30 minutes. She told me about things I won't share here, even in anonymity, because they're her things. I said a lot of things like, "That's awful. No, it's not fair." And, "No, I have no idea what that's like." Mainly, I just listened. I stared at my shoe, and she stared out the window, and during every other prolonged silence, I offered her a granola bar. Later, I would figure out that it's helpful to throw down a big piece of paper and a bunch of crayons and sit in straight-up color with nearly grown people in the event they wanted to come talk about their feelings. I am really, really, I promise, really crappy at problems that don't involve books. I'm not even that good at grammar stuff. It turns out that she liked that I didn't try to fix it. I didn't try to tell her everything was going to be okay. And I didn't treat her like it was my job to listen to her. She'd had poor experiences with all those things talking to the people whose job it really was to listen to her. So my room became a safe place for her to go when she needed to go somewhere. and often she didn't even talk to me while she was there. She would sit in a corner and draw, and I wouldn't give her grief about it, and I wouldn't try to sit and talk about feelings unless she wanted to. And then I mainly stared at my shoes some more. I introduced her to as many people in the building as I could be helpful, and they were. I stayed in touch with her parents, and we got through the things as a team of people trying to get through the thing. One time she came up to me in the hallway and told me to hold my hand out. I held my hand out, and she dropped 3 shards of a razor into it. "Did you use this?"
"No."
"Why did you give it to me?"
"I can't throw it away, but you should."
"Just a job, though, right?" This girl, by the way, is going to change the world. She'll save more people than I will ever know. She'll be your hero someday. If 10 bad life decisions and a couple of good ones led to me teaching in that school at the moment I needed to be there to help her by being a person, good. Screw everything else. It's totally worth it. It is beyond worth it. It is a privilege. Last week, I was sitting in front of school, and a giant man yelled my name as he ran across the street. The giant man was Darnell, whom I met as a 13-year-old 8 years ago. He ran up to me, lifted me up, broke nearly every bone in my body, giving me a hug. I still have a letter Darnell wrote to me on the last day of school, thanking me for making him not hate English anymore and believing in him. I didn't tell him that, though. I just smiled like an idiot, and he smiled like an idiot. And then he had to catch a bus and was gone. A parent came up to me at school once. She was there visiting her youngest, and her eldest was a few years removed from my class. He was heading into AP English this year.
"AP English!"
She grabbed someone walking past, someone neither of us knew.
"My son is starting AP English this year, and it's because he had this guy in 8th grade."
She was crying just a little bit more than a little bit. She was all filled up with pride in her son. A co-worker came over one night. It was Saturday night, and she was thinking about teaching, and I was thinking about teaching. So we thought about teaching together with some chips and hummus. She was in her first year and having trouble sleeping and having trouble relaxing or being productive at anything in the world other than teaching. She wanted to know when she would stop thinking about the kids all the time. "I don't know," I said. "Probably around the time that you should stop teaching."
Cheesy.
True. My prep time for a few years lined up perfectly with 6th grade recess. There was this group of boys that met every day in the gym for recess to play basketball. One time, the rims were lowered in the gym enough that I could dunk on them, which I did. A lot. It felt amazing. You get to laugh as a teacher. You get to play and laugh a lot if you let yourself. There's also this other one very not small thing. Teaching makes you a better person. Really, the whole job is learning to understand and appreciate people, to say or do the thing that will move them from where they are to where they need to be, to build and manage and value relationships with humans, to care and believe in people, especially when they can do neither for themselves. You can't be the person other people need you to be without always making sure your shit is as together as it can be. Teaching requires that you work at being a person and work at understanding people and the world and work at feelings and connecting and respect and ways into a magnitude that is not often asked of adults who aren't bartenders. In 10 years, I've grown more as a person than as a teacher. But that personal growth has translated into my being much, much better at my job. Also, every day that something god-awful happens in the world, I get to think about all the kids I know who are the ones who will make those things better. There are lots of reasons why teaching is completely worth it. I can almost hear people say now, "Oh, it sure ain't the money." They will then laugh just a little too long at their perception of my poverty, and as their laughter trickles off, they will punctuate their point for clarity, "Because teachers don't make shit." Yes, as a teacher, you will know people with nicer houses, cars, and more stuff than you. You can make good money teaching, but you won't get wealthy doing it. This should not surprise you. I mean, really. I don't imagine you could get as far listening to a book about teaching and think you could get private jet wealthy by teaching. Still, people joke too much. Teachers joke too much about the low, low pay of teaching. It's really not so bad. I will say something that almost no one will ever say, teacher or not. I make enough money. I mean, I work in a union school in a state that pays well and with a partner who has a job. There are very real situations where teachers are struggling to pay for essentials and meeting extra jobs. My experience is that in my state and in my school, it's really not so bad. Not only is the money not so bad, but joking too much about how little we make does distinctly bad things for teachers. We sound ungrateful for the money we make, and it is more than no money. There is a finite amount of the pie coming through public channels, and teachers make a good deal more than some, including some being paid to risk their lives. Also, except for a select group of suckers, administration who work year-round and deal with all the crummy parts of teaching, adults without a lot of the best parts, kids learning new stuff, teachers are the highest paid people in the building. It's just a jerk move to sit and whine to support staff and custodians, none of whom is working less hard than you, about how double what they make is not nearly enough money for you. When we joke about how little we make, especially around our students, we risk reinforcing that the profession we have chosen is a bad one. In the high school I went to, there was already an awkward divide between the new, shiny, show-offy cars of the student parking lots and the semi-old and very old Hondas of the teacher lot. Jokes by the teachers made the money divide more obvious and more uncomfortable. Brothers, I mean. My mom was a teacher's assistant then who drove a Geo, not even a kind of car anymore, and I got to school in a decade-old Toyota minivan that was shared among four siblings and is still, in many respects, the coolest car I've ever driven. I would trade the car I drive right now for one. So you don't make Lexus money when teaching, and most especially not while teaching and raising four kids by yourself. You do make enough money to have a car and a place to live pretty comfortably. That may not mean a lot to kids who come from wealth, who are people who teach out of a sense of service and stay because they respect the work and the profession, or quit when it's hard and stuff. But for someone who had less than everything growing up, my salary seems pretty great. Recently, I've been trying to talk to my students about teaching in a way that speaks opposite the constant jokes about poor teachers. A recent conversation started because a class was asking/demanding a pizza party. I've never thrown any class ever a pizza party, and was not of the mind to start. I have allowed use of my lunchtime and room to facilitate parties before, when the students figured out everything else and gave me a slice or two, but that's it. These students in particular were asking for me to pay for everyone's food. There's no way I have the money right now to buy 30 kids pizza. Oh, right, you're a teacher. True, I'm a teacher, and I am sometimes broke. I'm also an adult who made poor decisions about what house to buy and when. And I have a daughter who insists on eating and wearing clothes. And my wife and I have two cars that can have their keys locked inside of them in the same week, which requires two visits from the same locksmith, and sometimes it is 2 weeks before Christmas. So I'm broke for lots of different reasons other than my job. In fact, my job has been the things keeping all those other things from falling apart slash getting taken away for the past few years, while my wife finished up her school and license to be a therapist. I asked my students what they thought a good amount of money would be for an adult to make. They thought about it for a while, and I encourage you to do the same. I'll wait. They came up with $50,000 a year. And for many of my students, this is at least double their current family yearly income, and money that could buy them one heck of a lot more comfort than their lives currently hold. I like their number okay. Certainly people could make more than that and not be upset at all that extra money they have to deal with. Certainly people make less than that and lead fulfilling lives and still find the money to do the things most important to them. But $50,000 seems like enough money for a hard-working person to feel like they've earned what they make. In my 8th year of teaching, I made just north of $58,000. I taught summer school again, which in my district is 6 weeks long, 4 hours a day, and will make enough to push me above $60,000. It should be noted that Minnesota is a pretty good state to teach in. That is not no money. That's not crazy fantastic money, and it won't sustain a whole family at middle-class levels of stuff and weekly cell phone upgrades. But when I lock my keys in my car, I can call a locksmith. I can pay the $50 to have him open the door. It's not going to ruin Christmas. Also, during winter break, during which large chunks of this book were written, I will not work at all for 16 days, and it will cost me no vacation time at all. I get another 5 days for Thanksgiving, and another 9 for spring break. I am counting weekends, because we never seem to, but I have often held jobs that assumed weekend work, and getting a job with 2 consecutive days off when the rest of the world was available to hang out was a pretty big deal for me. Oh, yeah, plus summer. summer should maybe be its whole own chapter, or, because of its power and importance, perhaps we should avert our eyes like it is the sun. That's how big summer is. During the month of July, when I go almost nowhere that even rhymes with school, I don't like to swim, I am making the same amount as February, when only the happy light on my desk keeps me from losing my mind with stress and failure. February is why I need July, and I don't feel particularly guilty about getting the time off, but I do feel very thankful for it, and I do think it needs to be factored into the total package of the profession. I work summer school because I kind of like it, and the extra money is good. And I teach in an enrichment program that lets me teach dorky classes about stuff I'd probably be sitting around talking about anyway. In my career, that has meant classes that focus on video games, Star Wars, and superheroes. I go to staff development and meetings about grading systems and new initiatives at school, and welcoming new staff during the summer because I want to. And because I feel like all those things are part of the job, even if we don't get paid individually for each one. If I didn't want to do those things, I wouldn't have to, and then would have nearly 3 straight months, nearly 3 full months, which is, unless I lost a month somewhere in there, nearly 1/4 of the total year, when I don't have to work. My mom taught while I was growing up, and every summer she would take her 4 kids, some tents, one of those big orange water jugs, and a half ton of Kool-Aid to camp at a state park for 3 weeks. We became wild children who established whole systems of law, money, and justice built around bike tag, exactly what it sounds like, and a machine outside the general store that gave you a nickel for every soda can you put in. My dad didn't come because he mostly hated my mom, completely hated camping, and because there's no way in hell he couldn't have taken that much time off work. So I got these long trips with my mom every summer, and I'll get to take long, ridiculous trips and work on projects that go nowhere with my daughter as she gets older. And I don't know how much that is worth to everyone. That's worth a lot to me. Beyond the money, there's also the stability. This seems a fair point to admit that I have become old and lame enough to be really into things like job security. The kids are the first and largest reason, but the second biggest reason that I've never been seriously tempted to leave teaching is that I'm very, very sure I have a job next year and the year after that. This is true because I have tenure, and depending on where and when you're hearing this, what sort of licensure you do or don't have, or how successful I personally have been in pushing for reform of the tenure system, none of this may be true for you. In Minnesota, if you can keep from getting fired for 3 straight years while in the same district, you get tenure. Some districts do a whole lot of work with you in that time to see if you're doing great. I was seriously observed 2 times in 3 years, and then got a letter saying that I was nearly impossible for my small, monetarily strapped, administratively overworked district to fire, unless I really, sincerely, and repeatedly fucked up. Yes, districts can and do fire teachers with tenure, but the process they have to go through is costly and gives the teacher many, many times to find their shit and figure it out. It is quicker and easier to fire a teacher if they punch a student, parent, or coworker in the face. Don't do those things. Short of physical assault, I figure it would take my district about 2 years and a ton of money to quit me if I just stopped teaching and started showing cartoons every day. In fact, if I just started showing cartoons every day, it may take my students and everyone else at least 1 week to figure out that I was doing anything different at all. So I will likely not get fired. Losing my job then would come as a result of my district closing down, not out of the realm of possibility, as it is a funky district run by a few different school districts, any of which could pull out at some point. Were that to happen, I remain pretty confident that I could find another job doing what I do in another district, because we're going to need schools up and running until at least 1 year after the zombie apocalypse. With firing highly unlikely, and a school shutdown less unlikely, but still a process that would take a while, I can sit and say with decent confidence that I will have a job for at least 3 years. Few people, almost no one except teachers, get to say that sort of thing. Few people also get to say that the measure of their success at work have nothing to do with money. At the end of the day of teaching, there is no tally of customers served, no long ticker tape being printed with the day's totals. At the end of the day, I think about the things that went well, and the things that were disastrous screw-ups, and I think about what to do better the next day. Every few weeks, I get money in my account, from work, but the money of the job and the job are divorced from each other in my head. I like and really like that. Part 2. Fall. There was a time in your life when you had friends, enough time to read a book, and energy enough to stay awake past 7:30 p.m. That time is not fall. In fall, we uncover the work for the rest of the year. We discover and ask questions we have little hope of answering. Extra pants and other teacher essentials. In my first year of teaching, I kept a list of all the things I thought I would be good at other than teaching. I kept it on the desktop of my school-issued laptop and would look at it occasionally after a hard day or sometimes in the midst of a particularly rough hour. Though Juggler was perhaps unreasonable and Toby from the West Wing was perhaps unrealistic, the list helped. Partially, I needed to remind myself that teaching was a choice I was making. I needed to remind myself that the frustration that the one kid who just spent the entire hour staring at me as if she wanted to stab my face, that the early mornings and long days and weekends full of work and desperate attempts at sleep were things I could tolerate but didn't have to. Sometimes I looked at the list because I wanted to start planning how to get out. I'm convinced it's impossible to feel like you're doing a good job consistently through your first year. I've seen a few teachers who were convinced they were perfect right away, and they all got fired because they were actually terrible, and no one was sad, except probably them. I don't feel like I'm doing a great job on lots of days. There are too many things going on for every one of them to go right. Failures are often exceptionally loud and dramatic, and successes are often delayed and measured in small bits of inches. Still, there are some things you can do to make it easier to be better right away. The toolkit. I have a toolkit I buy at the beginning of every year, and I'm about to share it with you. Pay attention. This may be the only actually helpful advice I will ever give. Go buy these things, and here's why to buy these things. Advil. Obviously, but seriously. Small inconveniences you used to power through may well now take that last bit of patience keeping you from losing your shit. In other words, even small headaches can make bad teachers. Mints. This is particularly true if you are a coffee drinker. Don't be that teacher. Get some mints. Use them. They are a work expense now. Tide pen. Maybe for you, but it comes in handier for the kid focused on the new stain on their new shirt who you are asking to read someone's old poem. Lotion. This took me a long time to figure out because I'm white. Lotion is nice when you're white, but when your skin is darker, dry skin is a big deal. I watched for years as black kids would scour the school for lotion. Where would they find it? In the desks of three or four employees of our school who were black. Be a friend to black kids. Be an enemy to ashiness. Buy a bunch of lotion. Keep it out in your room for people to use. Do not be surprised when word spreads and students you do not have and do not know come to your classroom in the morning to use some. Pants. You may already have these. If you have more than one pair, store one somewhere at school. An extra shirt may not be a bad idea either. By pants, I really mean any extra outfit. Why do you need these things at school? I don't know why you may need them, but if you ever do, you will be very glad to have them. My school used to do a monthly advisory period that mixed kids from many different grades together. And on one early fall day, we played volleyball with giant beach balls and no points or rules, but a ton of laughing from those of us who knew we weren't too cool for it. Unfortunately, my pants were not as eager as I was to try and spike the ball onto the head of a fourth grader. I'm pretty sure every person in the building heard the sound of my pants ripping. But I had extra pants, and the pants happened to be less than 10 feet away. A quick trip to the locker room was better than spending the rest of the day on my desk chair wheeling around. Bring pants. Do no harm. For your first year, and probably your second, and probably every year after that too, swear to yourself to do no harm. Be aware that you will break that oath. Do your best to fix it afterward. When I was brand new to the profession, I taught 8th grade. The best thing about teaching middle school is that students are primarily waiting for their brains to start working again before they move to high school. This doesn't mean that there aren't great things to be taught, or that there won't be 1,000 moments to do things that are memorable, life-shaping, and inspiring that you can share with middle schoolers. Really, it means you have the freedom to do those things more often. But, you say, the standards! Of course, but you probably shouldn't care about those that much. Whoa, but wait! You are getting angry now. My school says I have to care. Okay. Then pretend to care. Work around them. Do better things.
You asshole, you are screaming. Have you read the math standards? No time! No time!
I hear you. I do. You're screaming, remember? I hear you, but screw it. If you promise to try really hard to teach important things that matter to your kids instead, then screw standards. Those of us in disciplines with standards that are based in skills and not content have it easy. English standards are more about how to read and write and not all the specific things you must read and write. I can do lots of different kinds of projects and still have the standards integrated. I mean, pretty sure I'm doing that. In my first year of teaching, I printed the standards out and had them displayed on the wall behind my desk, but I haven't read them since. Sorry. Not sorry. Standards, learning targets, and damn near all assessments come ultimately from a lack of trust in teachers. If they stop looking, of course, we would stop doing our jobs, of course. So, a lot of the stuff we get saddled with at school ultimately comes from a place of fear from the people making the rules and laws. And they are often directed at teachers so bad at being a human, they need to be forced to give a damn. There are some of those teachers out there, but not many. I work near one rather amazing elementary teacher in her second year. And every day there's some website she's supposed to check to see what she's supposed to teach that day so her class can be just like all the other classes in the district. She doesn't think she should pay a lot of attention to that because she'd rather do way cooler things. I very strongly agree. She could get lost in everything that she is told to do. She could get lost in hitting every standard every day so she could make her room a rich place to learn. She chooses to, you know, teach. I bet she hits most of those standards, and I bet she has a ton of them. But I bet those standards aren't quite as crazy as secondary math standards. Those suck. Math teachers, my message to you is this. You have two options. You can teach everything in the standards. To do this, you must go so fast through every concept that you mainly end up teaching a rehearsal of math and not real, deep knowledge of how math works. You will hit all the standards, though, in a way that each one of them will be spoken out loud in your room. Alternately, you can take your time with the most important concepts of the year, and you can make sure the kids really understand them and how to apply them, and how they work, and why they work. The better you get at teaching, the more things you can do, or at least you can get better at teaching the important things really well. It seems to me that path one will serve only your ability to say in a meeting that will likely never happen that you hit every standard in your room. Your students will know fewer things because you taught them so many. The second path, students will, I'm mostly sure, do better on tests and this is the important point for me. We'll be able to do more math for the rest of their lives. Plus, it's what your kids need. If you aren't willing to get in a little trouble to do what's best for your kids, then really this may not be the book for you. I think you are less important than kids are. You have to do no harm. Believe me, as a teacher, especially as a new teacher, putting a ton of pressure on yourself to achieve an unachievable goal that runs contrary to the way your students want to learn and the way you wish you could teach will not make you a happy person. It will not lend to great teaching. In that position, you run every chance of convincing students that they do not like your subject, but that they are just plain awful at it. You've heard those stories before, right? I thought I liked science, but then I had this horrible chemistry teacher and I hated reading in school. But once I got out, I realized, don't be that teacher. Your primary job is to show kids why your discipline is important and why people love it. You may not convince each and every student that Shakespeare is a fun weekend read, but they should understand why some people think so. They should know where their strengths are in your discipline, and they should be in a place as often as possible to show those strengths. Read with kids. I've always had a standing rule with kids. I will read any book they hand me, provided they have read it too. This means I have read lots of really bad books about submarine battles. There is an unreasonable amount of submarine novels out there, and one of my middle school boys just couldn't get enough of them and couldn't find a sucker to talk about them with, until me. I read a whole fantasy series that had something to do with rings or a belt or something. A belt, I think. And gems? Something like that. I read that series for months. Why? Because it was worth my time. And so was going to performances and playing kickball during gym and catching the second half of the basketball game after sitting in my room grading until dark. Teachers bristle sometimes about doing some of this stuff during their prep period. But this work is prep. It is some of the most essential work of teaching. Find dumb stuff to talk to kids about. Then talk to kids about dumb stuff. If you see more than one kid carrying a specific book, make sure you read it. It will likely be awful, but read it anyway. This was the reason I read the Twilight series. I offer no excuse for reading it twice. I had a student teacher in my high school class who was really into comics and developed an amazing connection with a group of our kids by spending months trading comics back and forth. A 30-second hallway conversation in which a student teases you for liking Daredevil even though he's lame, and you tease her because she likes Deadpool who is way more lame, can be the exact thing you need to feel like you belong where you are. Collect those little wins through the day, because you'll need them. A Tale of Two Teachers. A few years into teaching, I was put in charge of two new teachers. Well, I was put in partial charge of those teachers. No one at that point would have trusted me enough to be in charge of anything by myself. That statement is just about as true today. I told each of those teachers the same piece of advice. I told them to do all the things they got into teaching to do. I told them to make big mistakes, so long as they did the work to only make them once. I told them to give themselves time to figure out what they were doing, and in the meantime, to do no harm. That year was the tale of two very different teachers. Jenny became obsessed with her standards. There was homework for each day of the week, and a quiz every Friday for Jenny to assess each student's learning. Students asked constantly, "Why do we have to do this?" And were answered more often than not with, "Because we're supposed to." Let me start a new paragraph here just to highlight how awful an answer that is to a question. Students will ask constantly why they have to do an assignment or class, or why they have to follow a rule or procedure. If your answer is because, you need to find a new answer or not do that thing. Aside from teaching the students so many things that they learned almost none of it, and aside from overvaluing a very specific skill set in the process of grading, and aside from Jenny's classroom being so full of class that there was no time or room for any passion, Jenny created a spiral of work and stress that nearly drove her from the profession. Because of the sheer quantity of homework and quizzes assigned, she was grading during every available moment to try to keep up. Because the work was often uncreative and, to use an industry term, worksheety, grading was a soul-crushingly boring experience. Because Jenny was grading all the time, she felt like she was working all the time, and so she felt like she should be successful. When that work was not rewarded by creating engaged or high-performing students, she felt that she needed to work harder and harder until she had no more time or energy to give. Jenny added a whole level of work beyond planning and grading as well, the kind of work that is the truly exhausting part of the job. In the name of high standards, Jenny never, ever let a single thing go. Every behavior blip became a behavior issue, and she stood rigid and unblinking in front of any explanation, any compromise. For some kids, those rigid expectations provide a safe and predictable place. For some kids, those sorts of expectations provide a predictable form of entertainment when they want a power struggle for any of the 100 reasons that kids do sometimes. It's possible Jenny had never met a problem in life that was not solved by working harder, but teaching is just such a problem. Teaching is like trying to shove a couch that is too wide through a door. No amount of pushing harder is going to help until you figure out that you need to flip the damn thing on its side. Jenny spent the whole year pushing harder and harder on the couch, sometimes getting a good running start before slamming it against a door frame it clearly would not fit through. She began charting her homework scores, creating intricate graphs and charts of student progress and homework completion. She started calling or emailing home whenever a student missed a daily assignment, and started staying at school until the janitors had to lock the doors. Still, the couch never fit. The doorway may well have been shrinking. As an awful added bonus of awfulness, this teacher, this obsessively hard-working teacher, endured countless meetings with upset parents, countless comments from kids about class, and very little support from other teachers around her, wrapped in a cocoon of their own problems. She did not eat lunch in the staff lounge, did not come out to events or happy hours with other teachers. Jenny worked. She worked and worked, and things never got easier. And at the end of the year, it cannot be said, believe me, I wish I could say, that she was successful. Students did poorly in her class, They remembered almost nothing of what they learned longer than a day or two, and, by and large, were not compelled at the end of their eighth grade year to sign up for honors or accelerated coursework in that discipline in high school. Jenny never learned